eyes. What else can you say, Lexi Ken? True professionals. Sounds all right to me. Sounds peachy.
Chapter 30. A present. I decided that I couldn't handle staying at my old girl's. Too much of a heed nip. So Gav's pitting us up for the duration of Matty's funeral. The train journey up was uneventful, just the way I wanted it. Some fall tapes on the Walkman, four cans of lager in my H.P. Lovecraft book. Nazi cunt old H.P., but he can spin a good yarn. I set my coupon into the do not disturb or else cunt mode every time a smiling jackass apologetically squeezes into the seat opposite me. It's an enjoyable journey, and therefore a short one. Gav's new gaff is in McDonald Road. I decide to pad the hoof. When I get down to his place, he isn't in a happy frame of mind. I'm just about to get a bit para, like I've maybe imposed myself, when he indicates the source of his misery. Telling you, Rents, see that cunt second prize, he says, shaking his head bitterly and pointing to an empty front room. I gave him the cash to day this place up, a bit of plastering and painting. I'm away down to the B&Q, he says to us this morning. No seen the cunt since. My instinct was to tell Gav that he was crazy to commission second prize to do the job in the first place and totally fucking do lally, giving the cunt the poppy up front. I suspect, however, that's no what he wants to hear right now, and I am his guest. Instead, I dump my bag in the spare room and take him down the pub. I want to hear about Matty. What happened to the cunt? I was obviously shocked by the news, though it has to be said, Farfy surprised. Matty never knew he was HIV, Gav said. He probably had been for some time. Was it pneumonia or cancer-likes, I ask? No, toxoplasmosis, a stroke, Ken. Eh? I'm scoobied here. Fucking sad. Could only have happened to Matty, Gav shook his head. He wanted to see his wee lassie, that wee Lisa, Shirley's bairn, Ken. Shirley wouldn't let him near the house. No wonder the state of him at the time. Anyway, ken we Nicola Hanlon? Aye, we Nicky, aye. Her cat had kittens, so Matty gets one off her. The idea is that the cunt's gonna take it to Shirley's to gie it to the bairn, ken. So, he takes it to Wester Hills to gie it to wee Lisa, a present for her, ken. I can't really see the connection between the kitten and Matty having a stroke, but this sounds a typical Matty tale. I shake my head. That sums Matty up. Get a wee cat as a gesture, then leave it for some other fucker to look after. I bet you Shirley gave him the short shrift. Exactly, the clueless cunt, Gav smiles, nodding grimly. She says, I'm no wanting a cat to look after. Take it away, get to fuck. So there's Matty stuck with his kitten. You can imagine what happened. The thing was neglected, the litter tray swimming and piss shite o'er the house. Matty's just lying around, fucked out his eyeballs on smack or downers or just depressed, you ken the way he go. As I says, he didn't ken he was HIV. He didn't ken that you could get that toxoplasmosis for cat shit. I didn't ken that either, I says. What the fuck is it? Oh, it's fucking horrible, man. It's like, say, brain abscesses, Ken. I shivered and felt a crushing weight on my chest, thinking of poor Matty. I had an abscess on my knob once. Imagine having one on your fucking brain, inside your fucking head being full of pus. Fuck's sake. Matty. Fucking hell. So what happened? He starts getting headaches, so he just uses mare to blot out the pain, Ken. Then he has, like, a stroke. A boy 25, a fucking stroke, it's no real. I didn't recognise the cunt after it. Nearly walked past him in the street. This is doing the walk, Ken. He looked fucking ancient. He was all bent to one side, hobbling like a cripple, with his face all twisted. He was only like that for about 3 weeks. Then he had a second stroke and died. He died in the house. The pair bastard had been there for ages before the neighbours complained about the kittens' meows and the stench that was coming for the place. The police broke the door down. Matty was lying dead, face down in a poorly dried vomit. The kitten was fine. I thought about the squat Matty and me shared in Shepherd's Bush. That was him at his happiest. He loved the whole punk thing. They loved him down there. He shagged every bird in that squat, including that lassie from Manchester that I'd been trying to get off way for donks, the spawny wee cunt. It all started to go wrong for the pair bastard when we came back up here. It never stopped going wrong after that. Pair Matty. Fuck's sake, Gav muttered. That cunt perfume James, that's all we fucking need. I looked up and saw the open, smiling face of Perfume James coming towards us. He had his case and all. All right, James. No bad, boys, no bad. Where you been hiding yourself, Mark? London, I goes. Perfume James was a pain in the arse. He was always trying to punt perfume at you. Romantically involved these days, Mark? No, I took great pleasure in informing him. Perfume James frowned and puckered his lips. Gav, how's your good lady? All right, Gav mumbles. If I'm no mistaken, the last time I saw you down here with your good lady, she was wearing Nina Ricci, eh? I'm no wanting any perfume, Gav states with a cold finality. Perfume James twists his head to the side and extends his palms. Your loss. I can tell you, though, there's nae better way to impress a lassie than perfume. Fleurs are too temporary, and you can forget chocolates in these figure-conscious times. Still, nae skin off of my nose. Perfume James smiles, opening his case anyway, as if the very sight of these bottles of piss shall make us change our minds. I've done well the day, though, I can't complain. Your mate, second prize, as a matter of fact. I ran into him in the shrub an hour or so ago. He was quite bevied. He says, "Give some of that perfume, I'm away doing to Carol's. I've treated her like shite, it's time to spoil her a bit. Bought a fucking stack," so he did. Gav's chin visibly drops. He clenches his fists and shakes his head in angry resignation. Perfume James bounds over to the lounge in search of another victim. I flings back my pint. Let's see if we can find second prize, before the cunt drinks every bit of your money away. Much did you give him? 200 sobs, Gav says. Doss cunt, I says, sniggering. I couldn't help it. It was just nerves. I want my fucking head looked at, Gav concedes, but he can't force a smile. I suppose, when all's said and done, there isn't a fucking lot to smile about. Chapter 31 Memories of Matty 1
All right, Nelly, long fucking time no see, ya kind of ye are.
Franco smiled at Nelly, who looked incongruous in a suit, with a tattooed snake coiling up his neck and a palm-treed desert island with the sea lapping up drilled onto his forehead.
"Pity it has to be under these circumstances, likes," Nelly replied soberly.
Renton, who was talking to Spud, Alison and Stevie, allowed himself a smile upon hearing the first funeral cliché of the day. Taking up the cue, Spud said,
"Per Matty, fucking bad news, like say Ken."
"That's it for me. I'm staying clean," Alison said, shuddering, despite having her arms wrapped around herself.
"We're all going to be wiped out if we didn't get it together. That's as sure as fuck," Renton acknowledged.
"You taking the test yet, Spud?" he asked.
"Hey, come on, man. This isn't the time to be talking about that. Matty's funeral, I say."
"When is the time?" Renton asked.
"You really should, Danny, you really should," Alison implored. "Maybe you'd better know it, Ken.
I mean, like, see, what sort of life did Matty have when he kent he was HIV? That was Matty. What sort of life did he have before he kent he was HIV? Alison said. Spud and Renton nodded acquiescence at this point. Inside the small chapel attached to the crematorium, the minister gave a short spiel about Matty. He had a lot of burnings to fit in that morning and couldn't afford to fuck about. A few quick comments, a couple of hymns, one or two prayers, and a click of the switch to send the corpse down into the incinerator. Just a few more of these, and that was his shift finished. To those of us gathered here today, Matthew Connell filled a number of different roles in our lives. Matthew was a son, a brother, a father, and a friend. Matthew's last days in his young life were bleak, suffering ones. Yet we must remember the real Matthew, the loving young man who had a great lust for life. A keen musician, Matthew loved to entertain friends with his guitar playing. Renton could not make eye contact with Spud, standing next to him in the pew, as nervous laughter gripped him. Matty was the shittest guitarist he'd known, and could only play the Doors, Roadhouse Blues, and a few Clash and Status Quo numbers with any sort of proficiency. He tried hard to do the riff from Clash City Rockers, but could never quite master it. Nonetheless, Matty loved that Fender Strat. It was the last thing he sold, holding on to it after the amplifier had been flogged off in order to fill his veins with shite. Per Matty, Renton thought. How well did any of us really know him? How well can anybody really know anybody else? Stevie was wishing he was 400 miles away, in his Holloway flat with Stella. It was the first time they'd been apart since they moved in together. He was ill at ease. Try as he might, he could not sustain the image of Matty in his head. Matty kept turning into Stella. Spud thought that it must be really crap to live in Australia. The heat, the insects, and all these dull suburban places that you see on Neighbours and Home and Away. It seemed like there were no real pubs in Australia, and that the place was like a warm version of Babberton Mains, Buckstone, or East Craigs. It just seemed so boring, so shite. He wondered what it was like in the older parts of Melbourne and Sydney, and whether they had tenements there, like in Edinburgh, or Glasgow, or even New York, and if so, why they never showed them on the telly. He also wondered why he thought of Australia in connection with Matty. Probably because whenever they called round, he was lying junked on his mattress, watching an Aussie soap opera. Alison remembered the time that she had sex with Matty. That was ages ago now, before she was using. She would have been 18. She tried to remember Matty's cock, the dimensions of it, but couldn't visualize it. Matty's body came to mind, though. It was lean and firm, though not particularly muscular. He had skinny good looks and busy, penetrating eyes, which gave away the restlessness of his character. What she remembered most, however, was what Matty said to her as they got into bed that time. He told her, "I'm going to fuck you like you've never been fucked in your life." He was right. She'd never been fucked that badly, either before or since. Matty came in seconds, depositing his load into her and rolling off her, gasping breathlessly. She made no attempt to hide her displeasure. "That was fucking rubbish," she told him, getting out of the bed, all anxious and tense, charged up but unsatisfied, wanting to scream in frustration. She pulled her clothes on. He said nothing and never moved, but she was sure that she saw tears spill from his eyes as she left. This image stuck with her as she looked at the wooden box, and she wished she'd been a bit kinder. Franco Begbie felt angry and confused. Any injury to a friend he took as a personal insult. He prided himself on looking after his mates. The death of one of them confronted him with his own impotence. Franco resolved this problem by turning his anger on Matty. He remembered the time that Matty shat it off Gippo and Mikey Forrester in Lothian Road, and he had to have both the cunts on his puff. Not that it presented him with any difficulty. It was the principle of the thing, though. You had to back up your mates. He'd made Matty pay for his cowardice, physically with beatings and socially with heaps of humiliating slaggings. Now he realized he'd not made the cunt pay enough. Mrs. Connell was thinking about Matty as a wee laddie. All boys were dirty, but Matty had been particularly bad. Hard on shoes, reducing clothes to threadbare status in no time at all. She was therefore not concerned when he grew into punk, as he grew into adolescence. It seemed merely to be making a virtue out of necessity. Matty had always been a punk. One particular incident came to her mind. As a child, he had accompanied her to get her false teeth fitted. She felt self-conscious on the bus home. Matty insisted upon telling everyone on the bus that his ma had false teeth put in. He was a particularly loving child. You lose them, she thought. After they get to 7, they're no longer yours. Then, just when you adjust, it happens again at 14. Something happens. Then, when you put heroin into it, they're no longer their own. Less Matty, more heroin. She sobbed softly and rhythmically, the Valium measuring out her grief in sickening little breezes, attempting to dissipate the raging hurricane of raw angst and misery within her, which it simultaneously struggled to keep under wraps. Anthony, Matty's younger brother, was thinking about revenge. Revenge on all the scumbags who'd brought his brother down. He knew them. Some of them had the fucking gall to be here today. Murphy, Renton, and Williamson. These pathetic assholes who breezed around like they shat ice cream cones, like they knew something nobody else did, when all they were was junky trash. Them, and the more sinister figures behind them. His brother, his fucking weak, stupid brother, had got in tow with that scum. Anthony's mind cast back to the occasion that Derek Sutherland had beaten him up badly at the disused railway yard. Matty found out and went to have Dick Sutherland, who was the same age as Anthony and 2 years younger than himself. Anthony remembered his eager anticipation of Dick Sutherland's complete humiliation at the hands of his brother. In the event, it was Anthony who was again humiliated, this time by proxy. It was almost as intense as the one he'd received from Dick Sutherland himself, as he watched his old adversary almost casually overwhelm and kick the shite out of his brother. Matty had let him down there. He had let everybody down since. Wee Lisa Connell felt sad that her daddy was in that box. But he would have wings like an angel and go up to heaven. Her nana had cried when Lisa had suggested that might happen. It was like he was sleeping in that box. Her nana said that the box went away to heaven. Lisa thought that angels grew wings and flew to heaven. It mildly concerned her that he would not be able to fly unless they let him out of the box. Still, they probably knew what they were doing. Heaven sounded good. She would go there some day and see her dad. When he had come to see her in Wester Hales, he usually wasn't well, so she wasn't allowed to talk to him. It would be good to go to heaven, to play with him, like they used to when she was really wee. He'd be well again in heaven. heaven would be different from Wester Hales. Shirley held her daughter's hand tightly and tousled her curls. Lisa seemed to be the only evidence that Mattie's life was not a futile one. Yet, looking at the child, few could argue that it was not substantial evidence. Mattie, though, had been a father in name only. The minister had irritated Shirley by describing him as such. She was the father as well as the mother. Mattie had provided the sperm, came around and played with Lisa a few times before the junk had really got to him. That was his sole contribution. There had always been a weakness about him, an inability to face his responsibilities and also to face the force of his emotions. Most junkies she had met were closet romantics. Mattie was. Shirley had loved that in him, loved it when he was open, tender, loving, and full of life. It never lasted. Even before Smack, a harshness and bitterness would descend upon him. He used to write her love poems. They were beautiful, not in a literary sense, perhaps, but in the marvellous purity of the wonderful emotions they conveyed to her. Once he read and then set fire to a particularly lovely verse he'd written to her. Through her tears she asked him why he'd done that, as the flames seemed so symbolic. It was the most hurtful thing Shirley had experienced in her life. He turned around and surveyed the squalor of the flat. "Look at this. You shouldn't have dreams living like this. You're just conning yourself. Torturing yourself." His eyes were black and impenetrable. His infectious cynicism and despair took away Shirley's hope for a better life. It had once threatened to crush that very life out of her before she bravely said, "No more." Memories of Mattie, too.
"Keep it down, please, gentlemen," the harassed-looking barman pleaded with the hardcore of heavy drinkers the group of mourners had whittled down to. Hours of stoical drinking and wistful nostalgia had finally given way to song. They felt great singing. The tension flowed from them. The barman was ignored.
"Shame on you, Seamus O'Brien! All the young girls in Dublin are crying. They're tired of your cheating and lying. So shame on you, Seamus O'Brien."
"Please, will you be quiet?"
he shouted. The small hotel on the posh side of Leith Links was not used to this sort of behaviour, especially on a weekday.
"What the fuck's that cunt fucking saying? Entitled to give a fucking mate a fucking send-off?"
Begbie cast a predatory eye over the barman.
"Hey, Franco!"
Renton grabbed Begbie's shoulder, realizing the danger and trying to move him quickly into a less aggressive frame of mind.
"Mind you on time when you, me and Matty went down to entry for the National?"
"Aye! I'm fucking mindy that. I fucking tell that cunt that's on the fucking telly to go and fuck hisself. What was the cunt's name?"
"Keith Chegwin. Cheggers."
"That's the cunt. Cheggers.
The guy on the telly likes. Cheggers plays pop. Mind that?"
Gav asked. "The very same cunt," Renton said, as Franco smirked indulgently at him, encouraging him to continue the story. "We were at the National, right? This cunt Cheggers is doing interviews for City Radio Liverpool. Just blethering shite to punters in the crowd, Ken. Well, he comes out to us, and we didn't want to talk to the cunt, but you ken Matty, he's thinking this is fucking stardom. And he's gone on about how great it is to be here in Liverpool, Keith, and we're having a whaley of time, and all that shite. Then this DOS cunt, this Cheggers fucker, or whatever you call the cunt, thrusts the microphone in front of Franco." Renton gestures towards Begbie. "This cunt goes, 'Away and fuck yourself, you rag cunt.' Cheggers was fucking crimson. They've got that 3-second delay on the so-called live radio to edit that sort of thing out." As they laughed, Begbie justified his actions.
We're fucking doing there for the fucking racing, not to talk to some fucking DOS cunt on the fucking radio.
His expression was that of a man of affairs, bored with being hassled by the media for interviews. Franco could always find something to be enraged about, however.
Fucking sick boy should have been here. Matty was his fucking mate, he announced.
He's in France, but with a bird like say, probably couldn't cut him, man, Ken. I mean, France like say,
Spud drunkenly observed.
Makes no fucking difference. Rents and Stevie came up for London for this. If Rents and Stevie can come up for fucking London, sick boy can come up for fucking France.
Spud's senses were dangerously dulled with the alcohol. Stupidly, he kept the argument going.
Yeah, but, France is further away. We're talking about the south of France here, like, say, Ken.
Begbie looked incredulously at Spud. Obviously, the message had not got across. He spoke slower, higher, and with a snarl, twisting his cruel mouth into a strange shape below his blazing eyes.
If Rance and Stevie can come up for fucking London, sick boy can come up for fucking France!
Yeah, right enough. Should have made the effort. Mate's funeral, like say, Ken.
Spud thought that the Conservative Party in Scotland could do with a few Begbies. It's not what the message is. The problem is just communication. Begbie is good at getting the message across. Stevie was badly feeling the session. He was out of practice for this type of thing. Franco whipped an arm around him and another one around Renton.
It's fucking great to see yous cunts again. The fucking both of yous. Stevie, I want you to fucking look after this cunt down in London.
He turned to Renton.
If you go the same fucking way as Matty, I'll fucking sort you right out, you cunt. Listen to fucking Franco talking here.
If I go the same way as Matty, there'll be nowt left of us to sort out.
Dinny, you fucking believe it. I'll dig your fucking body up and boot it up and doon Leith fucking walk. Gas?
Nice to ken that you care, Frank.
Course I fucking care. You back up your mates. Sat fucking right, Nelly.
Eh? Nelly turned around slowly. Drunk.
I'm just fucking telling this cunt here. You back up your fucking mates.
True fucking right you do.
Spud and Allison were talking. Renton slipped away from Franco to join them. Franco was holding Stevie up, displaying him like a trophy to Nelly, telling him what a great cunt he was. Spud turned to Renton.
Just saying, Ali, this is heavy shite, all this, Lycee, man. I've been to too many funerals for a gadge my age, Lycee. Wonder who's next?
Renton shrugged. At least we'll be prepared, whoever the fuck it is. If they gave out qualifications in bereavement, I'd be a fucking PhD by now. They filed out into the cold night at closing time, heading for Begbie's place with a carry-out. They'd already spent 12 hours drinking and pontificating about Matty's life and his motivations. In truth, the more reflective of them realized, all their insights, pooled and processed, did little to illuminate the cruel puzzle of it all. They were no wiser now than at the start. Chapter 32 Straight Dilemmas, Number 1
Come on, have a bit of this, it's all right,
she says, holding the joint towards me. How the fuck did I get here? I should have gone home and got changed, then watched telly or went down the Princess Diana. It's Mick's fault, him and his quick one after work. Now I'm out of place here, still in my suit and tie, sitting in this comfortable flat amidst denim and t-shirt punters who think they're bigger wasters than they are. Weekend zanies are such a drag.
Leave 'em alone, Paula, says the woman I met in the pub.
She's really trying to get into my kicks, with that frantically obvious desperation you tend to find in such London scenes. She'll probably succeed, despite the fact that whenever I go to the bathroom and try to think of what she looks like, I can't conjure up even an approximate image. These types are irritating twats, plastic bastards. All you can do is fuck them, take from them, and then go. They even give you the impression that they'd be disappointed if you did anything else. I'm sounding like Sick Boy now, but his attitude does have its place, which is here and now.
Nah, come on, Mr. Suit and Tie. I bet you ain't had nothing like this in your life.
I sip at my vodka and study this lassie. She has a good tan and well-groomed hair, but this only seems to highlight rather than obscure a slightly wizened, unhealthy look. I spy with my little eye another dosk fucker in search of street cred. The cemeteries are full of them. I take the joint, sniff it, and hand it back. Grass weighs some opium in it, right? I ask. It actually smells like good gear.
Yeah, she says, a wee bit phased out.
I look again at the joint burning away in her hand. I try to feel something. Anything. What I'm really looking for is the demon, the bad bastard, the rage inside me who shuts down my brain, who propels hand to joint and joint to lips and sucks like a vacuum cleaner. He's no coming out to play. Maybe he doesn't live here anymore. All that's left is the 9-to-5 arsehole. I think I'll pass on your kind offer. Call me a wanker if you will, but I've always been a wee bit nervous around drugs. I know a few people who've been into them and run into difficulties. She looks intently at me, seeming to suss that it's what I'm not saying that's important. She obviously feels a bit of a tit and gets up and leaves us.
You're mad, you are!
The woman I met in the pub, what the fuck did she say her name was again, laughs too loudly. I miss Kelly, who's now back in Scotland. Kelly had a nice laugh. The truth of the matter is, the drugs thing just seems such a bore now. Even though I'm actually much more boring now than I was when I was on the skag. The thing is, this sort of boredom's new to us, and therefore no quite as tedious as it appears to be. I'll just run with it for a wee bit. For a wee bit. Chapter 33. Eating Out.
Oh God, you can tell. It's just gonna be one of these nights. I prefer it when it's busy, but when it's deed like this, time drags. No chance of tips either. Shite.
There's hardly anybody in the bar. Andy's sitting looking bored, reading the evening news. Graham's in the kitchen, preparing food that he hopes will be eaten. I'm leaning against the bar, feeling really tired. I've got an essay to hand in the morning for the philosophy class. It's on morality, whether it's relative or absolute, and in which circumstances, etc., etc. It depresses me to think about it. Once I finish this shift, I'll be up all night writing it up. It's too mad. I don't miss London, but I do miss Mark. A wee bit. Well, maybe a bit more than just a wee bit, but no as much as I thought. He said if I wanted to go to university, I could date in London just as easy as back home. When I told him it wasn't easy living on a grant anywhere, but in London it was impossible, just arithmetically impossible, he said that he was making good money and that we'd manage all right. When I told him that I didn't want to be kept, like he's the big pimp and I'm the cerebral whore, he said it wouldn't be like that. Anyway, I came back, he stayed, and I don't think either of us really regrets it. Mark can be affectionate, but he doesn't seem to really need people. I lived with him for 6 months, and I still don't think I really know him. Sometimes I feel that I was looking for too much, and that there's a lot less to him than meets the eye. Four guys come into the restaurant, obviously drunk. Crazy. One looks vaguely familiar. I think I might have seen him at the university. "What can I get you?" Andy asks them.
A couple of bottles of your best piss, and the table for four, he slurs.
I can tell by their accents, dress and bearing, that they are middle to upper middle class English. The city's full of such white settler types, says she, who's just back from London. You used to get Geordies and Scousers and Brummies and Cockneys at the uni. Now it's a playground for failed Oxbridge Home Counties types, with a few Edinburgh Merchant School punters representing Scotland. I smile at them. I must stop having these preconceived notions and learn to treat people as people. It's Mark's influence. His prejudices are infectious, a crazy prick. They sit down. One says,
"What do you call a good-looking girl in Scotland?"
Another snaps,
"A tourist!"
They speak very loudly, cheeky cunts. One then says, gesturing in my direction,
"I don't know, though. I wouldn't kick that out of bed."
You prick. You fucking dos prick. I'm seething inwardly, trying to pretend I didn't hear that remark. I can't afford to lose this job. I need the money. No cash, no uni, no degree. I want that degree. I really fucking want it more than anything. As they study the menu, one of the guys, a dark-haired, skinny wanker with a long fringe, smiles lecherously at us.
"All right, darling,"
he says in a put-on Cockney accent. It's a vogue thing for the rich today on occasion, I understand. God, I want to tell this creep to fuck off. I didn't need this shite. Aye, I do.
"Give us a smile then, girlie,"
a fatter guy says in a booming, officious voice. The voicey, arrogant, ignorant wealth unchallenged, untainted by sensitivity or intellect. I try to smile in a condescending way, but my face muscles are frozen. Thank fuck as well. Taking the order is a nightmare. They are engrossed in conversations about careers, commodity broking, public relations and company law seeming to be the most popular, in between casually patronising and trying to humiliate me. The skinny creep actually asks me what time I finish, and I ignore him, as the rest make whooping noises and do a drum roll on the table. I complete the order, feeling shattered and debased, and depart to the kitchen. I'm really shaken with rage, wondering how long I can control this, wishing that Louise or Marissa were on tonight, another woman to talk to. "Can't you get these fucking arseholes out of here?" I snap at Graham.
"It's business. The customer's always right, even if he's a fucking knob-end."
I remember Mark telling me about the time he worked at the Horse of the Year show at Wembley, doing catering with Sick Boy one summer years ago. He always said that waiters have power. Never mess with a waiter. He's right, of course. It's now time to use that power. I'm smack bang in the middle of a heavy period, and I'm feeling that scraped out, drained way. I go to the toilet and change tampons, wrapping the used one, which is saturated with discharge, into some toilet paper. A couple of these rich imperialist bastards have ordered soup, our trendy tomato and orange. As Graham's busy preparing the main courses, I take the bloodied tampon and lower it, like a tea bag, into the first bowl of soup. I then squeeze its manky contents out with a fork. A couple of strands of black uteral lining float in the soup before being dissolved with a healthy stir. I deliver the two patty starters and two soups to the table, making sure that the skinny, gelled fuck-up has got the spiked one. One of the party, a guy with a brown beard and phenomenally ugly protruding teeth, is telling the table, again very loudly, about how terrible Hawaii is.
"Too bloody hot. Not that I mind the heat. It's just that it's not like the rich, baking heat of Southern California. This place is so bloody humid you just sweat like a pig all the time. One is also continually harassed by peasant scum trying to sell you all their ridiculous trinkets." "More wine!"
the fat, fair-headed prick petulantly booms at us.
I go back to the lavvy and fill a saucepan with my urine. Cystitis is a problem for me, particularly during my periods. My pish has that stagnant, cloudy look, which suggests a urinary tract infection. I dilute the carafe wine with my pish. It looks a bit cloudy, but they're so smashed they wouldn't notice. I pour a quarter of the wine into the sink, topping up the carafe with my pish de resistance. I pour some more of my pish onto the fish. It's the same colour and consistency as the sauces which marinate it. Crazy! These pricks eat and drink everything without even noticing. It's hard to shite onto a piece of newspaper in the toilet. The bog is small and it's difficult to squat. Graham's also shouting about something. I manage a small runny turd, which I take through and mix up with some cream into the liquidiser and merge the resultant mess with the chocolate sauce, heating away in a pan. I pour it over the profiteroles. It looks good enough to eat. Too rad. I feel charged with a great power, actually enjoying their insults. It's a lot easier to keep smiling now. The fat bastard has drawn the short straw, though. His ice cream is laced with ground-up traces of rat poison. I hope Graham doesn't get into trouble. I hope they didn't close the restaurant down. In my essay, I now think that I'd be forced to put that, in some circumstances, morality is relative. That's if I was being honest with myself. This is not Dr. Lamont's view, though, so I may stick with absolutes in order to curry favour and get high marks. It's all too mad. Chapter 34. Train spotting at Leith Central Station. The toon seems sinister and alien as I pad it down for the Waverley. Two guys are screaming at each other under the archway in Colton Road by the post office depot. Either that or the cunts are screaming at me. What a place and time for a kicking. Is there ever a good one, though? I quicken my pace, which isn't easy with this heavy hold-all, and get on to Leith Street. What the fuck's it all about? Wide cunts. I'll fucking keep moving. Sharpish. By the time I get to the playhouse, the noise for the two arseholes has been replaced by the appreciative chattering of groups of middle-class cunts as they troop out of the opera. Carmen. Some of them are making for the restaurants at the top of the walk, where reservations have been made. I stroll on. It's downhill all the way. I pass my old Montgomery Street gaff, then the former junk zone of Albert Street, now sandblasted and tarted up. A police car frantically lets rip on the siren as it hurtles down the walk. Three guys stagger out of a pub and into a chinky. One of the cunts is willing us to make eye contact. Any flimsy pretext to fill some fucker in, some widows will grasp it with both hands. It's the old discreet increase of pace again. In terms of probability, the further you go down the walk at this time of night, the more likely you are to get a burst mouth. Perversely, I feel safer the further down I get. It's Leith. I suppose that means hame. I hear gagging sounds and look down this alley which leads to a builder's yard. I witness second prize, bulking up a load of bile. I discreetly wait for him to pull himself together before talking to him. Rab, you all right, man? He turns round and wobbles on the spot, trying to focus on us, when all his heavy eyelids want to do is crash down, like the steel shutters of a late-night Asian show power the road. Second prize says something which sounds a bit like, "Hey, Renz, sound as a fucking pound, ya cunt." Then his face sort of changes and he says, "Fucking cunt, I'll fucking have you, ya cunt." He lurches forward and swings at us. Even with my hold-all, I can step back fast enough and the nondy cunt crashes into the wall and staggers backwards, falling on his arse. I help him up, and he's talking a load of shite, which I can't make out, but he's at least more passive now. As soon as I put my arm round him to help him along the road, the Raj collapses like a pack of cards with that learned helplessness that chronic drunks have, as he completely surrenders himself to us. I have to drop my travel bag to support the fucker, to stop him falling and taking another second prize for the pavement. This is useless. A taxi cruises up the walk and I flag it down and stick second prize in the back of it. The cabbie doesn't look too pleased, but I gave him a fiver and say, let him out down the Bowtow, pal, Hawthorne Vale. He'll find his way home for there. It's the festive period, after all. Cunts like second prize just blend in at this time of the year. I was tempted to get into the taxi with Sex and jump off at my ma's, but Tommy Younger's looked too tempting. Begbie's in, hadn't caught with a few widows, one of whom looks familiar.
Rents, how you fucking doing, you cunt? This you just up for London?
Aye. I shook his hand and he pulled us to him, slapping us hard on the back. Just dumped second prize in a Joe Baxi, I said.
That cunt. I tell him to fuck off. Second fucking bookable offence of the night. Cunt's a fucking liability. That's worse than a fucking junkie yon. If it hadn't been Christmas and that, I'd have fucking tanned the cunt myself. That's me and him fucking finished. End of fucking story.
Begbie introduces us to the cunts in his company. What second prize did to get flung out of that crowd, I didn't even want to ken. One of the cunts was that guy Donnelly, the Sockton kid, a Raj way Mikey Forrester used to air slick. Seems the cunt tired of Forrester one day and gave him a sound stomping. Hospitalisation job. Couldn't have happened to a nicer guy. Begbie pulls us aside and drops his voice.
You ken that Tommy's fucking sick.
Aye, I'd heard. Go and fucking see the cunt when you're up. Aye, I plan to do that. Too fucking right. You e all fucking people should. I'm no fucking blaming you, Rents. I says that to fucking second prize. I'm no fucking blaming Rents for Tommy. It's every cunt's ain fucking life. I fucking tell that to second prize.
Begbie then goes on to tell us what a great cunt I am, looking for us to reciprocate, which I dutifully do.
I act as a prop for Begbie's customary ego-boosting for a while, playing the straight man and telling the company some classic Begbie stories, which portray the cunt as hard man and stud extraordinaire. It always seems more authentic coming for somebody else. The pair of us then leave the pub together and head down the walk. I just want to get my heat down at my ma's, but the beggar insists that I come back to his bit for a bevy. Strutting down the walk with Begbie makes us feel like a predator rather than a victim, and I start looking for cunts to gie the eye to until I realise what a pathetic arsehole I'm being. We go for a pish in the old central station at the foot of the walk, now a barren, desolate hangar, which is soon to be demolished and replaced by a supermarket and swimming centre. Somehow, that makes us sad, even though I was too young to mind the trains ever being there.
Some size of a station this was. Get a train to anywhere for here at one time, or so they says, I says, watching my steaming pish splash onto the cold stain. If it still had fucking trains, I'd be on one out of this fucking dive, Begbie says.
It was uncharacteristic for him to talk about Leith in that way. He tended to romanticise the place. An old drunkard, whom Begbie had been looking at, lurched up to us, wine bottle in his hand. Loads of them used this place to bevy and crash in.
What is up to you, lads? Train spotting, eh?
He says, laughing uncontrollably at his ain fucking wit.
Aye, that's right, Begbie says, then under his breath, fucking old cunt. Ah, well, I'll leave you to it. Keep up the train spotting mind.
He staggered off, his rasping drunkard's cackles filling the desolate barn. I noticed that Begbie seemed strangely subdued and uncomfortable. He was turned away from us. It was only then I realised that the old wino was Begbie's father. We were silent on our journey towards Begbie's until we came upon a guy in Duke Street. Begbie hit him in the face and he fell. The gadge briefly looked up before trying to pull himself into a fetal position. All Begbie said was, "Wide cunt," as he put the boot into the prostrate body a couple of times. The expression the guy had when he looked up at Begbie was more one of resignation than fear. The boy understood everything. I didn't even feel like trying to intervene, even in a token way. Eventually, Begbie turned to me and nodded in the direction we were headed. We left the guy slumped on the pavement as we continued our walk in silence, neither of us looking back once. Chapter 35. A Legover Situation. It was the first time I'd seen Johnny since his amputation. I didn't ken what state I'd find the cunt in. The last time I'd seen him, he'd been covered in abscesses and still talking shite about going to Bangkok. To my surprise, the cunt was exuberant for somebody that had recently lost a leg.
"Rents, my man, how you diddling?"
"No bad, Johnny. Look, I'm really sorry about the leg, man." He laughed at my concern.
"Promising football career up the creek. Still, it never stopped Gary Mackay, did it?"
I just smiled.
"The White Swan when he be in dock for long. Once I get the hang of that fucking crutch, I'll be back on the streets. This is one bird's wings that can't be clipped. They'll take my legs, but never the wings."
He wrapped an arm round his shoulder to pat to where his wings would have been if the cunt had any. I think he believes that he does.
"And this bird you cannot change," he sang.
I wondered what the cunt was on. As if reading my mind, he says,
"You gotta try that cyclozine. Shite on its own, but see when you mix it with a methadone. Faw, you cunt! Best fucking high I've had in my puff. That includes that Colombian shit we had back in 84. I ken you're clean these days, but see if you try now else. Try that cocktail."
"Reckon I?
It's the fucking best. You ken the mother superior, Rents. I believe in the free market when it comes to drugs. I've got to gee the NHS its due, though. Since I had this pin off and went on the maintenance therapy, I've started to believe that the state can compete with private enterprise in your industry and produce a satisfying product at low cost to the consumer. The methadone and cyclozine combined, I'm telling you, man, fuck me. I just get down, get my jellies for the clinic, then look up some of the boys that get the cyclozine on script. They gie it to the pair cunts with cancer, for age likes. A wee swap, and every cunt's chuffed to fucking bits."
Johnny ran out of veins and started shooting into his arteries. It only took a few of these shots to give him gangrene. Then the leg had to go. He catches us looking at the bandaged stump. I can't stop myself.
"I ken what you're thinking, you cunt. Well, they never took the White Swan's middle leg."
"I wasn't here," I protest, but he's pulling his dick out of the top of his boxer shorts.
"Know that it's much fucking use to us," he laughs.
I note that his knob's covered in dry scabs, which indicates that it's healing up.
"Seems to be drying out, though, Johnny, the abscesses likes." "Aye, I've been trying to stick to the methadone and cyclozone and stop the injecting. I thought when I saw the stump that it was an opportunity, another access point, but the hospital cunt says, forget it. Stick a needle in there and that's you well fucked. The maintenance therapy's no too bad though. The White Swan strategy is to get mobile, get clean, and then start dealing properly, just for profit rather than use."
He pulls out the waistband of his shorts and scoops his scabby gear back in. "You want to get a fucking bye, man," I suggest. The cunt doesn't hear a word I'm saying.
"Nah, the aim's to get a fucking bankroll together, then it's off to Bangkok."
His leg might have gone, but his Thailand escape fantasy's still intact.
"Mind you," he says, "I didn't want to wait until I get to Thailand before I get a fucking ride." That's what this reduced dosage shite does for you. I had some root on us the other day there, when the nurse came round to do the dressing. An old boot and all, and there's me sitting with a bairn's ear with an apple on the end of it.
"Once you get yourself mobile, Johnny," I venture encouragingly.
"Like fuck. We wants to shag a one-legged cunt. I'll have to pay for it. A big come-down for the white swan. Still, you're better paying for it with birds. Keep the fucking relationship on the strictly business footing."
He sounded bitter.
"You still nubbing Kelly?"
"No, she's back up here." I didn't like the way he said that, and I didn't like the way I responded.
"That cunt Allison came round the other day," he says, revealing the saucy's spite.
"Ali and Kelly are best mates."
"Oh, aye. To see the fucking freak show."
He nods at his bandaged stump. "Come on, Johnny. Ali wouldn't have that attitude." He laughs again, reaching for a decaffeinated Diet Coke, ripping the ring back and taking a sip.
"There's gin in the fridge," he offers, pointing to the kitchen.
A nod in the negative.
"Aye, she was round the other day. Well, a few weeks ago now, I suppose. I goes, 'What about a gam doll? For old time's sake, likes. I mean, it was the least she could do for the Mother Superior, the White Swan. We fucking saw her all right plenty times. The cold-hearted bitch KB'd us.'" He shook his head in disgust. "I never legged that wee whore, you ken. Never in my puff. Even when she was ganting on it, she'd have let us fuck her always for a fix at one time."
"Right enough," I conceded. It was true. Or was it? There was always a wee bit of silent antagonism between myself and Ali. Didn't he really ken why? Whatever the reason, it makes it easier for us to believe the worst about her.
"The White Swan would never take advantage of a damsel in distress, though," he smiles.
"Aye, sure," I says, totally unconvinced.
"Too right I wouldn't," he stridently contends. "I didn't, did I? The proof of the pudding's in the fucking eating."
"Aye, only because you had skag in your boz."
He goes, touching his chest with a can of coke. "The White Swan doesn't fuck out his mates. Golden rule number one. No for smack, no for nout. Never question the integrity of the White Swan on that issue, Rents. I wasn't a skaggy bod all the time. I could have had her cunt on toast if I had have wanted it. Even when I was skaggy bod, I could have pimped her out. Easy fucking meat. I could have had the bitch down Easter Road in a short skirt and nae kecks, gave her a jab to keep her quiet, and stuck her on the flare of the pishies behind the shed. Could have had the whole fucking home support on a line-up, with a White Swan standing outside charging a fiver a skull. Even with a flunky thrown in, the margins would be astro-fucking-nomical. Then didn't he tiny the next week, let all the infected jambo bastards go in after the boys had had their fill."
Incredibly, Johnny's still HIV negative, in spite of being involved in setting up more shooting galleries than Mr. Cadona. He has a bizarre theory that only jambos get HIV and hibbies are immune.
"I'd have been set up. Retirement job. A few weeks of that and I could have been in Thailand. A posse of oriental buttocks packed on my cootin. Didn't do it though, cause you can't fuck out your mates."
"It's tough being a man of principles, Johnny," I smile. I'm wanting to leave. I couldn't handle a round of Johnny's fantasized oriental adventures.
"Fucking right it is. My problem was I forgot the wrong yans. Nae sympathy in business, and we're all acquaintances when it comes to the law of the dragon, but no. Soft-hearted bastard that the White Swan is, he lets friendship come into it. And how does that selfish wee hangout repay us? I asked her for a wee blowjob, that's all. She was going to gear set and all, out of sympathy for the leg, ken. I'd even got her to get mair of the makeup and lipstick on. Heavy duty lights, ken. So, I whips it out. She takes one look at the weeping sores and bottles it. I says, "Dinna worry, saliva's a natural antiseptic."
"That's what they say, right enough," I acknowledge. "It's getting on."
"Aye, and I'll tell you something else, Rents. We had the right idea back in 77. Oh, that gobbin we did, drown the whole fucking world in saliva.